Thank you very much. Die Erwiderung wird wieder auf Englisch sein, Diskussion auf Deutsch und Englisch. Thank you very much, Jennifer von Schwerin, for this fascinating and very rich application of Kubler's theory in your paper, Space, Time and Design in a Maya Temple Architecture. Your example, obviously, is an 8th century Maya royal temple at the famous site of Copan in Honduras. And you offer a very stimulating parallel reading of Kubler's and Gendrop's approaches to differentiate stylistic periods among pre-Columbian peoples, and here specifically of the Maya of Central America. Again, my comments have more of a meta character, to which you might reply, and much in the style I did this with Kerstin Schankweiler. I have 3 points I want to talk about. The first is style, the second, creativity, and the third, practice. First, style. I agree that Kubler's concept of sequence can be used to redefine regional styles in Maya art history and archaeology. In fact, you quote and later paraphrase Kubler, and on pages 3 to 4, a historical network of gradually altered repetitions of the same trait. And again, as with Kerstin Schankweiler this afternoon, I think we would benefit by using Alfred Gell's theory, Art and Agency, complementarily, which has a long chapter on style. And interestingly, in that chapter, he links style to memory and past and future resonances of events, recall and the past and future resonances of events or artworks. And here he extends very much on Husserl's, Edmund Husserl's important contribution on the phenomenology of inner time consciousness, zur Phänomenologie des inneren Zeitbewusstseins, is the central work here by which Gell is influenced. And he also builds on Marcel Mauss's notion of objectification of social relations and Marilyn Strathern's and Roy Wagner's ideas of the fractional personhood. Marilyn Strathern and Roy Wagner are Melanesianists, anthropologists for the last 20 or 30 years working in Melanesia and Polynesia, have come up with the idea that there is really no bounded person as we conceive it of in the West, but rather that persons are distributed along lines of kinship, of exchange relations, along historical networks and so forth. And this is also what much, together with Husserl's influence, inspires Gell. Gell then sees aggregates of artworks, including modern and contemporary art, as distributed objects of an extended mind, where agency of a creative individual or a group over time can be read from different biographical events, instantiated as artworks, and this during an individual's or group's life course. Gell then sees artworks both as a process where an artwork can go through several stages of ideas, sketch, finished work, and later copies, as well as being part of a larger temporal series during an artist's or group's lifetime. Such theorizing, where temporalities rather than individual indexes or artworks are essential, have important implications for the concept of style and indeed the intrinsically linked category of repetition, without which, so Gell says, art would lose its memory. Although there is no reference to Kubler by Gell, we cannot ask him any longer whether he had read Kubler, the following quote shows a very similar understanding, further complemented through the implicit notion of agency for both objects and their makers. And I quote, "But at the same time, we can easily conceive that remembering something which happened in the past is very like copying a picture that one has painted in the past, or that making a preliminary sketch for a picture is very like mentally anticipating some future happening or course of action," end of quote. Second, creativity. Now, extending on Gendrop, you then point out that the Maya, I quote you, were creative in very small or in small ways within a genre. And you pose the question, when does a genre or style change? And that is also at the basis of your paper, how would changes occur? And again, here it is interesting to look into the research anthropologists have done on creativity. And the most recent research is, for example, by Tim Ingold, and together in a book he edited with Elizabeth Hallam on creativity and cultural improvisation in 2007. They say that creativity and improvisation are first generative, they produce culture, they are relational, second, in relation to others, and they are temporal, that is of a certain duration, and that tallies directly with Kubler's concerns. And they also write, I quote, that copying is not the simple mechanical process of replication that it is often taken to be, of running off duplicates from a template, but entails a complex and ongoing alignment of observation of the model with the action in the world. In this alignment, they say, lies the work of improvisation. The formal resemblance between the copy and the model is an outcome of this process, not given in advance. It is a horizon of attainment to be judged in retrospect. Indeed, the more strictly standards are observed, the greater are the improvisational demands placed on performers to get it right. And the examples they quote are not from pre-Columbian art and architecture, although one might well make that transfer, but for example, Javanese dance and Chinese and Japanese calligraphy. Third, practice. It is perhaps apposite that I make this remark here in the Cologne Art Association, im Kunstverein, a place where works of practicing and contemporary artists are shown. I don't think it's a coincidence that one of the great scholars of Maya and Mesoamerican pre-Columbian art, in fact, a great contributor to the decipherment of the glyphs, of the language, was Linda Scheele, trained as an artist, as indeed have been other researchers. And I should perhaps add that Kubler's work is not only of interest to Central and Mesoamerican pre-Columbian and colonial art, which were his main specialism, although he wrote, of course, also on the other Latin Americas more generally, but it is also very much of importance to people working in South America. And I think here in particular of the highly original and innovative work of another artist scholar, like Linda Scheele, of Cesar Paternoster, an Argentinian minimal artist working in New York in the 1960s and 70s, but then also inspired by Kubler, and he was in contact, for example, with Lucy Lippard, who then was working on her art, how contemporary art and the art of prehistory links. I just had an email exchange with him, and he told me that Lucy Lippard then said at the time that everybody was reading George Kubler in the artistic communities, contemporary art community in New York, was reading George Kubler. And Paternoster also had exchanges with the late George Kubler in the early 90s. And Cesar Paternoster then wrote an important contribution, which is called The Stone and the Thread, Abstraction in the Andes, which was published by Texas University Press in the mid-1990s. And he put out another work called Abstraction, the Amerindian Paradigm, which is a large curated show and catalog at the Palace of Fine Arts, Palais des Beaux-Arts in Brussels in 2000. And in both of these, he tries to retrieve a genuine concept of abstraction. So not so much the preoccupation here with figurative art, although we also have abstraction, of course, in Mesoamerican and Central American pre-Columbian art, and thus establishing and retrieving a sui generis concept of abstraction amongst the Andean people, starting with their textile art, which has relevance to the present day in ethnographic arts, and culminating in the Incaian monumental sculpture. This is perhaps also the other important point of Kubler's work, of having impacted on studies with an emphasis on artistic creative approaches and practice, such as Paternoster's and Scheele's, for example. So the question then is, what can practicing artists, as it were, attain from reading and applying Kubler's work? What they, and more specifically, what could they contribute and this is more for you to answer, to the study of, and can continue to contribute to the study of pre-Columbian art and artifacts. And finally, I wanted to mention also, and we had a conversation about that just in the break now, very interesting your notion of social performance and how that might relate perhaps to performance theory, and you mentioned Schechner yourself in our brief conversation. So these are the points I have to make. If you want to respond to him or say something, and then I open the discussion.
Thank you so much for these comments. Where to begin? Style, performance, Richard Schechner. Yes, one of the things that interests me about architecture is that it's a group activity. It's not something that one person does. And so there has to be consensus, and it's a performance in who commissions and who builds it, and how and when and how fast and in what context. And I, in my dissertation working with this temple, looked at the construction of Maya temples as performative events. And thought about, okay, now, why is this form ever reappearing? What does it have to do with the performance of the temple? What kind of performances happened there that required certain spaces that then needed to be built? And I looked at accession ritual and used Richard Schechner's concept of the performance that's actually the audience and the actors are participating equally in the event. And then thought about Paul Connaughton's work on social memory, and then I've forgotten this other man's name, I should know it, about concepts of ritual and stages in ritual. And then I looked at the stages of ritual accessions in Mesoamerica and the kinds of architectural spaces they required, and then looked at the temple in this way to see and confirm that it is built for this type of performance. The aesthetic experience of walking through the space and seeing somebody emerge from a mouth and being reborn and down to the style of the carving, the animated nature of it. So performance is really important to thinking about this. I haven't fully worked through it all, and I wish I had attended your conference in 2009 on performance. But I think it has a lot to do with repetition and ritual, that these the morpheme or the signal is continually carried. And I haven't thought that through well enough. With regard to creativity, I'm very interested in the technical side, what do you say in German, the Widerstand des Materies, or so, the technical problems that the artists work with architecture. There are technical constraints. There are also social complexity constraints. You can only build a certain type of building with a certain type of social structure. And I think that has a lot to do with what I was looking at here. The most interesting discussions I've had are with stone carvers down in Copan. They tell me what kind of stone is softer, what kind of stone holds better together, and why certain stones were used on the building. And perhaps my thought with regard to technical practice and talking with artists is that this stone sculpture that appears on this temple at this time doesn't necessarily appear because they ran out of stucco to make high relief facades, but because they simply realized, wow, this stone is so soft, we can make three-dimensional forms. At any moment, you can choose to make an abstract form or a three-dimensional figurative form, and I think that the technical side of the work has something to do with that, the joy of working with a technical material. I think that's all I can add to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So now the floor is open. Questions, comments, please? Fragen, Kommentare?
This is an awful thing to do, but I actually had an epilogue on my talk that is a subject that has absolutely not been addressed until Jennifer's. And I think it's absolutely essential for Kubler's understanding Kubler, and that is to actually understand that time for him was not some universal abstract thing, but actually there was Maya time, there was Aztec time, and he studied their concepts of time, and many times, in fact, reflected upon the fact that perhaps their time held a much greater sense of usefulness and truth than our Gregorian time. So I just wanted to read a quote from him, because I frankly would do this, but I don't know enough about Aztec calendars to do it without quoting it. But I think you'll find his irony here interesting. I close with a view into Amerindian time before 1500 in the Valley of Mexico at the Aztec capital of Tenochtitlan. This manuscript in Paris, the Codex Borbonicus, painted on native paper, is a folded screen centered upon two square panels that portray the dominant calendar of Mexico. On the left, an ancient couple discuss the count of time that surrounds them. On the right, two supernatural beings also discuss their surrounding frame of year signs. These signs of the years have long been understood as showing two rounds of the 52-year Mexican cycle. But these year signs here are each separated by long intervals as marked by the presence of the nine gods of the night, interlocking with other cycles of 13 days and 9 month positions in a solar year of 365 days, as well as a concurrent cycle of 260 days used for divination. In brief, the shortest cycle of nine lords of the night is the clue to its total duration. It establishes a period enduring 20,176 years in which we and Aztecs today still occupy the same place in its first quarter of 5,044 years. Such a concept of time appears here in the associated mythology of a universe in continuous creation by undergoing periodic destructions. The mythology of cosmic ages named, oops, I've got a little, it went small on me, sorry. The mythology of cosmic ages, named for their destructions by wind, fire, flood, and earthquake, this mythology was widely believed in the 16th century America from Mexico to Peru. Calendars reminded people both of the fragility of the natural world as well as the possibility of continuous creation in the universe. But our present-day Gregorian calendar has no warning system built into it, as the ancient American calendars. To conclude, like those who ignore history, we too may be condemned to repeat it. So, I mean, he wrote a book called The Tovar Calendar. So all of his life he was interested in that. And I think your morpheme of being time and being a cosmic diagram of time, which absolutely obsessed, you know, pre-Columbian and many ancient people. And this whole idea that Kubler interested in these long durations, you know, that, you know, here we are thinking about a couple of centuries and, you know, and their whole time was charted, you know, back for thousands and thousands of years, you know, is something that's not been talked about. But when we talk about transculturation, I mean, you have to think about, well, how did Aboriginal peoples think about time? How did ancient Chinese think about time? That becomes a really important thing that we've not talked about a whole lot until your paper. Sorry.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That I think I'm influenced in talking about this theme because that's just the theme we're talking about at Morphomata right now. Not comparative studies of time across cultures, but looking at the concept of time and different the way different cultures address it. And I just want to show one slide that I really wanted to bring up. The concept of time, Nancy Ferris and Anthony Avini have worked with concepts of time in Mesoamerican culture. And the important point is that time only moves forward through collective ritual. And it is these events, you could talk about Kubler's concepts of events, that keep time moving forward. And ethnographies of Maya people today, they think about time as something that needs to be continually carried, and then it's set down, and there are intervals between moments in time. It's not a continuous sequence. And time replicates itself in a cyclical way, not in a linear way. There are very, very interesting ways to think about time, and then how the Maya themselves thought about architecture when they buried a building and then put another building on top of that, what they were thinking about, what that meant in terms of marking time.
Thank you for the very interesting talk. I was just wondering or thinking about the concept of morphome and form again. We just talked about yesterday, and I'm a bit obsessed, maybe. I was just wondering if Kubler and Morphomata are taking up two quite different perspectives on one object, maybe. And like, if I understood it right, Morphomata looks on static forms or concrete forms and the different meanings they can take in different times and contexts and places. Is that correct?
Correct me if I get this wrong, Terry. It's a concrete manifestation
of an idea.
Of an idea. that is recognizable over time by its reemergence as a pattern that's recognizable. So that's similar. Kubler talks about that in that way.
Okay. And it's like the form changes not that much. It's like a continuity of form.
Well, there are the three steps that the way that these two professors who have this institute have outlined, right? The genesis of the form, and then its dynamic state in which it's changing slightly but still recognizable. So it is understood to change, as well as this disjunction problem of form and meaning separation, right? That's also there. But the fact that the form reappears, whether or not the meaning stays the same, is important.
I just thought that you study this double-headed serpent doors, I don't know the correct name again, and then it's just like the form remains relatively static, and you look for... Yeah, for a little movement, and you ask for a prime object. If at one moment it changes in a prime object, and then there exist replicas. Yeah. But what Kubler asks is, what's the problem? And maybe they have the same form but different problems. I don't know if this could...
No, that's my fault of not explaining the paper well enough, because there was so much that I was trying to do. The form that I'm looking at is really a three-dimensional diagram of the universe. The starry sky serpent is just one part of that. And it appears and disappears depending on what aspect of the universe at the time the temple is built that they're wanting to address. The problems with archaeological studies are that you only have relative survival of objects, right? So I can't even show you complete temples. I'm showing you pieces. So in some manifestation of the morphome or the form, a part of it appears and another part of it appears. And we're making assumptions in some places. But it's larger than just that one piece.
I was just wondering if I thought that was very interesting that Kubler studied different time concepts in other cultures. Do you think that his model of temporality and the shape of time came out of these studies, or did he do that later?
In 1946, right after the war, he and Charles Gibson, a very famous historian who was a graduate student at that time, took on the Tovar calendar, which were a whole series of kind of fragments. And so he entered calendrical studies then. You couldn't study pre-Columbian art in the earliest moment, you know, without actually dealing, you know, with the calendar. And calendrical studies were absolutely essential, as they were, you know, the interest of, you know, medievalists and kind of, you know, temporal representations and manuscript illumination was similar. And so as he wrote The Shape of Time, there's one place where, I can't quote it right now, actually it's in this epilogue, I won't read it though, he basically is asking whether there is any natural segmentation of time. And so he goes through, we have 5-year lustrums, 10 years, decades, and then what is 20 years is called a scores. Then he says 100 years, the century means nothing. He then goes back and looks at generational theory. He says, well, we can begin to calculate that time will change in generational ways. Right, so what is a generation? Depending on how you construct it, right? It can be 14 years, it can be 20 years a generation changes. And that would reflect that, you know, a biological model that, you know, you get old and time changes. So he rejected that. And then he got, you know, really kind of interested in the Maya Katun and these 20-year periods that are 52 years for the Aztecs, but, you know, the 20-year cycles. And he kept saying, you know, maybe they were right. They were looking at time much longer than we were. That's why this whole thing about the length, he said, here, these people have been observing time for all this thing. Why don't I actually pay more attention to their cycles? And at a certain point, Colin Martindale comes along, and what does he say in his empirical studies, that the length of time before major change sets in are 20-year periods, which is really close to, you know, kind of some of the pre-Columbian Maya and Aztec things. But he would never say, you know, that he believed it. If you looked at my whole thing was set up with phases of Kubler, each one of them was 20 years. Each one of them was 20 years. And I didn't force it. And that's why I had this end, that if you actually looked at what Martindale said, you looked at what, you know, Maya time changes, you know, that 20 years. Mm.
But in the book, he identifies 60-year duration with 15-year intervals.
Which were the, and the 15 were the generations, right? So
right.
15 years would be generational change, you know, and he measures those by when a human being could begin to practice artistic things. So, you know, you would, for the first 16 years, you would probably not be making art. I don't know. But he writes a lot about that, and it's always fascinated me. You know, particularly, I'm always interested in, I've written a lot on Latin American centenarios, and, you know, giving paper how ridiculous it is actually to look at, you know, centenaries. You know, they actually mark nothing. And so I've done a paper where I actually look at the major periodization of major change in Argentina and dictatorial governments and democracies in Latin America and look for the segmentations of time that are more natural. And you come much closer to 20 years.
I have a question here, actually, again, for both of you. How, but especially to Thomas, actually, on Kubler, how much he was interested in music and theorizing on music, because of those who know the essay by Edmund Husserl on the inner consciousness, time consciousness, is of course this idea of retentions and protensions that, and it has to do with phenomenology and perception. That is, when you perceive music, at the moment you hear a sound, you also hear it, or in a piece of music, you still hear sounds past, of a moment past, and you also have, with the sounds, a foreboding of the next future sound. Mm-hmm. And the question is whether he engaged with Husserl or with other theorizing of phenomenologists.
I don't know everything about Kubler, but...
No, but, but
I frankly,
if anybody knows...
I mean, you know, I knew he loved the theater. His, you know, he went to the theater an awful lot. I know he talked always in Munich about attending the opera when he was a kid, you know, all the time, you know, just... And then in 32, 33, just loved, you know, the opera there. But I never heard him talk very much about music. His wife actually liked... You know, it's a great, one of the great music schools at Yale, and they regularly attended concerts, but I never heard him talk very much about it. Although when you talked about memory, I mean, this whole eidetic imagery thing for him, right, was a memory image. I mean, you know, it was basically that he could stare at something and then project that visually. And you know, he didn't know what it was. He just kept saying, in certain lights, I see these objects. And that's why he started researching it, because he thought he was kind of a nutty thing. But it was a memory, you know, it's a memory image that's burned. Mm-hmm. About music, I never heard him talk a great deal. I never heard him really theorize a lot about theater either, or about performance, or, I mean, he might well have done so, but
I got the feeling from the his book on the, what was it, the shape, before, I've forgotten the article now, the title, the Shape of Space in Maya Architecture, where he talks about the formal features, and they strike me as observations from a theatrical point of view. I mean, he talks about the spaces between buildings and differentiations and height and very sort of phenomenological, experiential aesthetics of Maya architecture, and I wonder, I mean, I've been thinking, you know, to what extent can we move through these spaces and get at the same sorts of experiences that the architects were trying for us to experience just by our own bodies, by the phenomenological experience. I'm making sense. So I would think that whether or not he'd read Husserl, he's interested in these problems.
Weitere Kommentare, Fragen?
Do you know whether there's also a relation, for example, to Bergson or to other time concepts in the writing of Kubler?
I mean, actually, you know, he had, you know, read Bergson and through Faucillon, and, you know, makes a very, as I said in my talk last night, makes a very, you know, strong critique of it, right? You know, that was the part, I mean, you know, it, I must say that the critique of Bergson comes later, you know, than when Faucillon was writing. I mean, it comes later, this vitalistic criticism of vitalism. And so I think Kubler picked that up and decided, you know, really he wanted to move as far away from it as possible in The Shape of Time. I think a lot of that rejection is what basically led him to a totally different formulation in The Shape of Time. One other thing I would love to ask about that we've not heard about here, and it's actually going back to the last talk, and that is this universal history of art. The one person who has, I think, attempted this actually is David Summers in this 900-page book, which actually was inspired. David and I were in the Kubler seminar on Teotihuacan when he began the work on Teotihuacan together. And it was in that seminar that, you know, David Summers began to think about what 40 years later he produced, 900-page book. And it is an attempt really to create a methodology to look at works of art across cultures. And as so much that David has written, people say, have you ever read David Summers? Can you understand a word he says? Is this book actually known and used at all here? I've forgotten its exact title, but do you all know the David Summers book? Yeah, I mean, it is a very difficult, but he basically tries to create a methodology based on Kubler. I can't say based entirely on Kubler, but inspired by Kubler, in which basically he can take, you know, forms and tries to do to create a method where its value, its cultural values are taken away. It's a kind of formalist approach to universal architecture. And David is very funny. His book on Michelangelo, got reviewed. He spent 20 years writing it, and he said, you know, everybody, he said, I thought I knew more about Michelangelo than anyone, and in fact, I know I do. And he said, nobody really could read my book. You know, they gave up after about 6 pages and write a bad review. I mean, this is another one of these books, though. Look for it. Because it is Kubler inspired.
Well, if there are no more questions, I suggest we have Jennifer to have the last word now, unless somebody has a very urgent need still to express themselves, then I think Jennifer should close this, because we have later a performance, I think, and we need a little break in between. So Jennifer, please.
Thank you for the opportunity. I don't have much to say except to thank again the I can't speak English either. The people who organized the conference, you three, thank you very much. This has been very stimulating for me, and I look forward to the talks tomorrow.